whilst others are wasting their time and harming themselves by searching for excuses for their defects, the earnest philosophical student improves his time and helps himself by searching for constructive ways of amendment. He will need humility to recognize his own deficiencies instead of being engrossed in other people's, but the reward will be commensurate. Every provocation by the faults, sins or errors of other persons offers him the chance to practice the casting out of negative reactions to it. The more irritating it is, the more he should smile because of the greater opportunity thus given him. He may regard it also as a test. A provocative situation should be regarded as a profitable chance to start the inner work on it without allowing the common negative reaction to start first. Thus, impatience and irritability at being kept waiting on an appointment can be kept out by immediately declaring his possession of infinite patience, and by remembering the eternal now, with its infinite acceptance of life. Nevertheless, prudence counsels him to avoid places and persons and situations which are likely to arouse the lower nature. These things are better faced by the strong than by the weak, by the mature and purified than by the young, ungrown and unseasoned. If he knows, for instance, that proneness to anger is one of his failings, then, until he wins some rulership of the empire of self, it would be prudent to avoid those situations which may provoke his anger. It is an important part of the disciple's task, this conquest of personal emotion. Life itself will present him with opportunities to test how far he has gone in the direction. They are opportunities to desert a lower point of view for a higher, opportunities to raise, purify or depersonalize his feelings when they are of a negative character. This self-denial brings commensurate spiritual rewards in terms of enduring advancement. Such opportunities will show themselves most conspicuously in connection with his relation with other persons. Differences, frictions and disharmonies which might otherwise arise on both sides can now be limited to one side, and that not his own. He can remain cool, collected, unresentful, and unagitated where the temptation might be to behave in an opposite way. Let him think deeply and calmly for a little, and he will see that many of these so-called human feelings and human attitudes are really undesirable, and that he should not submit to their tyranny nor excuse himself on their account merely because they are so common and so widespread. Let him reflect that it is in spite of their faults and weaknesses that he likes his friends or loves those near and dear to him. He would not like or love them any the less if those faults and weaknesses were to disappear. On the contrary, he would like or love them all the more. And if this be true of merely human faults and weaknesses, how much truer still must it be of those baser faults and weaknesses, those gross animalities and hard feelings which bring out the worst in humanity. That part of him which changes with the emotional tides, which fears, desires, desponds and jubilates by turns, cannot be eternally preserved, either in life or after death. Nature will still subject it to the evolutionary law, will still put him into experiences which, by making him aware of his unsatisfactory limitations, will not allow him to find peace until he turns away from resting self-complacently in them. Is it not inhuman, if not even somewhat insane, many will object, to ask a man to adopt an attitude towards his own personal life somewhat like that of a chemist observing elements in the laboratory? Can anyone ever become so totally detached, so utterly cold, so wholly unmoved and so impassively analytical towards the experiences and events that matter most to him? But such questions show a misconception of the philosophic discipline. To help clear this up, let us ask ourselves a further question. Why is it so much easier to examine the past rather than the present to see where we go wrong, to discern the true opportunity from the deceptive one, and to recognize real friends as against false ones? Mentalism answers it is because the personal ego interferes more easily when we are actually involved in any situation than when we can look at it in long-range perspective. And this in turn happens because emotion is uppermost in us at the time of any happening, because we excitedly take it to be a material reality. Whereas, after it has receded into a memory, that is a thought, we unconsciously begin coolly and unexcitedly to accept it as having been such even originally. Looking upon it as a thought, we are able to adopt a calmer, more detached attitude towards it now. The calmness with which we are able to view the past is deliberately cultivated by the philosopher as he views the present. Tranquil impersonal feeling is the very essence of his attitude. Feeling is too strong a motive in human life ever to be killed. But when it is egoistic, it ought to be tamed. That is all philosophy asks of man. Human feeling is not called upon to eliminate itself, but to elevate itself. Human emotion is not to be destroyed, but to be understood and guided. Nobody can afford to ignore feeling, but must certainly come to terms with it. For it provides the heat which shall energize his life. It gives driving force, but he needs also to see where he is being driven. Its strength is no substitute for the safety of right direction. To gain this protective sight, both the guidance of reason and the prompting of intuition are required. He needs the light of intelligence also, and he needs it even more than heat. It tells him in which direction to move. If he moves in a wrong direction, then the more dangerous will his situation become. Better if he generates the heat out of his light, then he will both walk aright and walk well. Therefore, emotional faith must be bridled by reason thinking. It is enough for most to follow their feelings blindly, but the student, remembering that philosophy can make no room for any mystification, must question his own. If they turn out to be leading him in a right direction, then he will follow them just as eagerly as the others do. But he will have the additional satisfaction of seeing where he is going. It is not that he must cast out all feelings from his heart. It is rather that he casts out what is unworthy and unlovely from feeling, what is low, negative, base, destructive, egoistic, agitated, false and neurotically self-pitying or sentimental. Yes, feeling remains, but it is purified, ennobled, exalted, calmed and made philosophically truthful. Indeed, unless his feelings are aroused, the aspirant will never know the over-self. But those feelings are to be the lofty ones of devotion, reverence, veneration and love of a kind to which earthly love can only point but never parallel. The quest must arouse his intensive emotion, his deepest feeling. They must mingle with his intellect, his intuition and his will in their service of it. Consequently, it cannot be a cold affair nor a lifeless one. The true philosopher is not made of stone, nor is he without a heart. But all this feeling is not scattered in 100 different directions. It is given up to the one thing that attracts it most, to the over-self. He is not unfeeling, cold and inhuman, but he expresses only the highest emotions, or better still, he is emotionally free. To understand the desirability of such a state, we have only to contrast his durable serenity with the tumultuous emotionality of the neurotic, the hysteric, and the psychopath. Emotion is so powerful a factor in human life and so valuable a one in human action, that it would be foolish to ask anyone to dispense with it. Philosophy does not ask for such a thing. But it does ask for a proper balance between emotion and reason and a sensible coordination between emotion and intuition. What most men do not see is that their real enemy is more often inside themselves than outside. For it is noticeably harder to reason out a situation calmly than to feel about it emotionally. Emotion in itself is neutral. It is not an evil to be overcome. It may ally itself with an evil idea, but it may also ally itself with a good one. The philosophic discipline calls for its conquest when it is joined to a false or evil idea, for it then chains the man to it. Therefore, the disciple, who must live more carefully than most people, will have to make a distinction between the lower and the higher emotions. He will have to discourage the one group and encourage the other. The lower emotions are to be firmly ruled by reason, the higher ones are to be harmoniously allied with it. All must be brought under control by a persistent self-imposed discipline. Refined by intuition, exalted by moral purpose, they are a powerful asset in his spiritual endeavor. But left to sway unchecked hither and thither or to overpower his thinking and will, they are a lamentable debt. He must not be easily moved. Three practical methods for cleansing and calming the emotions may be profitably included in every regime. The first is to take advantage of the power of habit. Thus, The habit of dwelling inordinately on woman's beauty leads in the end to the desire for woman, whereas the habit of dwelling often on the soul's beauty leads in the end to the desire for the soul. The second method is to make use of the opposite thought, the contrasting idea. He should take a moral quality which represents the very contrary of the weakness which is troubling him. In his daily meditation he should bring this desired quality or trait before his mind's eye and picture himself possessing it, identify his character with it. The creative power of such concentration will emerge in the course of time, for it will percolate down into those idle moments when the mind instinctively flies back to its desires and passions at the sight of some external stimulant. The firm decision to cleanse his mind, followed by the practical endeavor to nip every wrong thought in the bud, is the third method which has helped many an aspirant. If he keeps to the method, it will produce definite results. Even within a few months, the improved condition of his mind will be quite noticeable, but the success of the method depends upon catching each thought at its very birth and not waiting for it to grow up into a sturdy plant before attacking it. He should learn to cherish right emotion, but spurn false emotionalism. This done, the emotional will no longer be the foolish, whilst the intellectual will no longer be the ineffectual. To curb spendthrift emotions, or even to put them into rational straitjackets, becomes desirable whenever they draw an aspirant away from pursuit of the ideal. Something of the Stoic is indeed to be cultivated. When passion is finally brought to heel by intelligence and emotion eventually guided by impersonality, in both cases through the channel of the will, he is set free from many needless anxieties and safeguarded from many avoidable perils. His outward life will then run its course more quietly and more surely, as his inward life will enjoy more serenity and more freedom than other men's. There are many to whom such life of inward independence is terrifying and repulsive. They do not see that their own uncriticized enslavement to bitterness and desire, to hatred and ignorance, to greed and prejudice, their own complacent crucifixion of the ideal, is what is really terrifying and repulsive. Or they declare it inhuman, thus standardizing man by what is base in him instead of by what is best. The weakling who yields at once to a sensual impulse, who does not think of entering into conflict with it, merely lives for the moment. He never cares to pause and consider what it is he is living for. That the best of life can be had only by a discipline of life is something known to more people than to philosophers. There is a pleasure from the results of such discipline which is known to those who float with the instincts and the senses. When the quest enjoins the cultivation of a firmer will in certain directions, it would be a foolish thing to do it in a spirit of sullen obedience. The end of such cultivation can only be a truer enjoyment as well as a newer enjoyment. To make such a stand against the common and constant identification of himself with the impulses and emotions in his ego, is sooner or later a necessary act on the part of an aspirant to spiritual light. If he repeats this act a sufficient number of times, there will come to birth within his inner life a kind of fissure. There will be an observing self and an observed one. This may not be evident all the time, but it will be clearly evident at critical times and in important situations. In short, he will be coming under the guidance of, and sensing the outermost aura of, his over-self. The difficulties he formerly encountered in separating himself from his lower nature and the dread of unbinding himself from his ego may have discouraged him from even beginning on the quest, but as against this he can now reckon the joy of following its obviously wise injunctions, the fascination of studying its history, background and ramifications, and the reward of edging little by little towards the supremely desirable condition of self-mastery. As the will becomes stronger and the intestinal tract cleaner, the process of self-spiritualization becomes easier. Chapter 13. The Silent Call of the Over-Self. 20th century man lives in an astounding age which too often prefers the blaring call of the saxophone to the silent call of the spirit. He spends the major part of his days in agitated pursuit of minor things. He wanders eagerly in quest of crowds but is unable to spare a second in quest of that stillness wherein, the Old Testament tells us, he can find God. By inclination and education the Westerner is an extrovert. His thoughts are constantly being drawn hither and thither, his feelings worked up by environment and events. He even becomes so intoxicated by his own deeds that he cannot stop doing something or other. This unbalanced extroversion, this continuous preoccupation with the physical aspect of life which is modern human existence, is with the masses too often largely necessity, but with the more fortunate classes deliberate choice. This impetuous desire to keep active, this eagerness to submit to a constant round of activities or engagements, this terrific pace of today which keeps either the bodies or the minds of people continually on the move, is aggravated by the harsh pressure and raucous noise of contemporary city life. The intensification of physical living obsesses modern energies and intoxicates modern minds. When added to the macerating wartime experiences through which so many millions of people have passed during this decade, it hardens the nerves and produces an insensitive materialism. It fills the atmosphere with unending strains. The resulting traumas have inevitably produced a crop of unpleasant psychoses and tormenting neuroses, of unhappy mental disorientations and discouraging nervous exhaustions. Neurotic people are more plentiful than at any previous time in human history. They are the inevitable byproduct not only of a devastating war, but also of 20th century machine environments and complicated pressures of living. If serenity ever had any worth, surely it is today, when violence, destruction, turmoil, change, chaos and flux heave their troubled waters. Life is now so agitated that there is real need for a remedy for war neuroses and peace anxieties, for an antidote to the unprecedented strains and psychological stresses of the world crisis. It is common enough to see the unrelaxed man hasten to accomplish his daily programs as soon as possible and remain nervously tense until he has done so. It would seem as if he were engaged in an endless hurried chase, entering on it anew each morning with impatience at the time it takes and in a rush to get through the immediate tasks. He gives clock-ruled time, and not intuitive rightness, the greater importance. The turbulence of his inner life and the triviality of his worldly interests waste his limited years and show either common insanity or personal inanity. He uses his self-created programs of activities as an excuse for postponing spiritual repose, and in most cases the postponement is protracted for the rest of his life. Under existing conditions, the mere business of attending to the details of living is so heavy that too much of his strength and day is taken up by its long littleness. It is so complicated that even a simple concentration on the spiritual life is hurdled with artificial obstacles. So he ties himself to the circumference of self and never takes or finds time to get at its center. Modern man is rightly occupied with making money, but when his occupation becomes preoccupation, when it becomes so extremely dictatorial that it prevents him from all thinking about the higher goals of living, or when the spending of what he makes prevents it, he is courting trials and troubles from unexpected directions. The business of keeping his body fed, clothed and sheltered may take up much of his time and most of his energy, but it ought not to prevent him attending to the higher business of finding his soul. The nervous unrest, hurry and excitement of our times leave no room for other than a life of fleeting sensations and brief impressions. Under such conditions, the deep and enduring things begin to disappear. The shallow and sensual begin to rise prominently above them. Love is replaced by lust, thoughtful reflection by mere curiosity, and men follow treacherous will over wisps which lead them into marshes where they sink and suffer. On every side there is the spectacle of man fleeing where they sink and suffer. On every side there is the spectacle of man fleeing from true life and hugging the mere illusory appearance of it, because that is easier than submission to its demands and acceptance of its readjustments. Yet he does not seem to realize that he is the real escapist. It is a noticeable trend of this century, more undoubtedly in the modern West than in other areas, that seeks to crowd the utmost number of sensations into the day's experience. The trend has developed to a fantastic degree and has certainly contributed to the phenomenal increase in our times in medical cases of high blood pressure and premature heart failure. The relentless pressures of the 20th century man's daily program cause him to race through it and thus wear himself down. He who foolishly starts his activities or movements in such a desperate rush to finish them, such a fierce endeavor to exhaust himself sooner than is necessary, does not realize that he has to pay sooner or later for his foolishness. We must regret the fact, but good intentions do not carry with them any guarantee against such error in living and its consequential suffering. Just as the introvert's desperate need is not more thoughts but more deeds, so the extrovert is not something he can do but something that will help him refrain from deeds. When sickness forces an extreme extrovert to take to his bed, do nothing, and be still, it may confer a real benefit on him by allowing his powers of reflection and intuition to become more active and useful to him. This forced confinement between bedsheets affects not only the invalid's body but also his mind. He is granted an opportunity to get some fresh perspective on his life's course and some fresh balance in its judgments. He finds himself in possession of an invaluable gift to an opportunity to revalue those judgments, a pause in this course and a chance to see more deeply into the meanings of its past happenings and present circumstances no less than its future possibilities. Pressures then begin to lose something of their weight and urgencies to lose something of their speed. Here beneath these blankets he really relaxes, perhaps for the first time in many years, and the over-self, which could not bring him to meditation on his life purposes by pleasanter ways, now gains its end by unpleasant illness. How many people find illness a time when relaxation, reflection or prayer are enforced upon them, with results which beneficially influence the remaining years of their lives? How many times does the rest demanded by illness allow unrestricted play to nature's healing forces to remedy what has been brought on by disobedience to the hygienic laws of the body? Thus nature balances its physical injury to it. If the body falls sick because its own proper hygiene is not being obeyed, because the laws governing its healthy functioning are being broken, then the sickness may prove useful to the extent that it arouses the sufferer to the need for living rightly and warns him to reform his physical habits. This should prompt the physician, who incidentally is recommended by Hippocrates, the founder of European medicine, to be also a philosopher, to reflect on the large number of illnesses which are really the seeking for refuge from the self's own imbalance, carelessness or self-poisoning. He should further reflect on the large proportion which can be prevented if the persons concerned can be made to understand the danger signals which the intuition flashes to them, warning them to withdraw for a while into simple repose or spiritual retreat from the excessive tensions of work, passion, worry and negative emotion, or from faulty habits of eating and drinking. Where failure to recognize the correct nature of these signals leads to illness and the compulsory repose of, and retreat into bed, the patients have then the opportunity for possibly long neglected and much overdue reconsideration of the basis of their life and the standards which govern it. If they refuse to accept it, if they are too hurt by their physical suffering or too ego-centered by their emotions to examine themselves and their conduct, then of course the sickness does nothing but harm to them. Nevertheless, it is a paradoxical fact that the same ill health which promotes relaxation and reflection and thus may lead indirectly to a brief spiritual illumination, may also in another person obstruct such an illumination. The general law governing this manifestation is that the body ought to be in a healthy condition if the mind is to receive the illumination correctly and without hindrance. As if so much turmoil, agitation and pressure were not enough, too many become and remain isolated from nature through the artificial circumstances of contemporary city life, as well as through wrong thinking and faulty living regimes. None need be surprised that all this has serious and harmful results from the philosophic point of view. Under its rule, men tend to lose what religious faith they have or else never come to know mystical intuition. It prevents them finding the time to think for themselves about their life, its inner problems, higher goals and deeper significance. It destroys the capacity to think for themselves as individuals, and largely lessens the ability to bring their thinking into a concentrated state. It works destructively against the leisurely deliberate quietness of the spiritual attitude. Even many a spiritual aspirant tends to accept the suggestions of these massed numbers of people who constitute the society around him and who are not interested in or engaged upon this same quest as himself. He creates fictitious duties for himself as the result. He finds himself without the time to study and think, to pause in the silence or meditate, and without the energy to divert his attention from the external course of events. Thus there is no escape for him unless he becomes an individualist. Western man has explored and subdued most of the planet's surface. He has yet to explore even one-tenth of his own inner self. Because he has made an ever-moving, impatiently energetic and ambitious life the ideal one, he, more than others, needs to correct this one-sidedness. His agitations and activities may be virtues in his own eyes but are smiled at by those among the Orientals who still keep faithful to their inner heritage and leave themselves enough time for worship, meditation, silence and solitude every day, and who thus keep an inner life as the core of the outer one. The Western habit of trying to keep occupied all the time leads to frayed nerves and moral confusion. The redress exists in making a place in the daily routine for learning the art of mental quiet. Intervals of the fullest mental and physical repose need to be inserted in this routine. The Occidental's repressed longing for inward peace has itself prepared him for the advent of these psychologic doctrines and mystical methods which can now help him to help himself. That there is an unconscious recognition of this need to secure better balance by taking to relaxational practices is evidenced by the steadily growing popularity of cults advocating such practices. How different is the attitude of the relaxed man who attends to each step and lives each moment tranquilly and concentratedly. He possesses a serene feeling of leisure, a feeling incredible to those whose attitude is that every hour must be a busy one. He lives at his own pace. Not that of an unbalanced and frenetic society. His whole life moves to a different tempo, one without haste, peaceful and pleasant. There are even aimless hours in it which would be a madness to the modern Westerner. Yet he is neither a drifter nor a loafer. The general direction of his life has a well-defined purpose. His attitudes and actions have an undersurface meaning. The exercise of unruffled calmness under all circumstances is a definite aid in every way. Out of it there comes naturally an accurate discernment of values and a balanced judgment. There are moments in most lives of great tribulation or of great temptation when controls may be easily shattered, but this is much less true when calmness has been cultivated. The relaxed man never permits himself to get so angry about anything that he loses self-control. His judgments will naturally be dispassionate and disinterested and not conditioned by his desires. His appraisals of the most hotly disputed issues will then be balanced and fair, and more likely to be correct and reasonable. He will not make a negative criticism without at the same time making a positive suggestion. How can modern man dissolve his unrest and find such a desirable inward peace? He can do it by finding himself. He must begin with an antidote to his excessive extroversion. He can find this most effectively in the deliberate practice of introversion in either relaxation or meditation, or both, as a daily exercise. How few people have such a mystical life today? The present generation, war-weary and surfeited with extroversion, may be ready to welcome philosophic truth and mystical practice. It has tried long enough to live without a higher purpose. This has always failed in the past, as it is failing today. The prolonged immersion in externals has begun to produce in more sensitive individuals a mutual recoil upon the spiritual life. Yet modern living holds too many distractions to permit the easy attainment of inner peace without making a self-denying struggle for it. What can be done by those who are forced to take their share of the cares and pressures of everyday life? The idea of calling a sudden if temporary halt to all this feverish activity is to some people an unpleasant and irritating one. Yet that is precisely what philosophy bids them do. They are apartments to get so sunk in worldly interests and social pleasures, in personal activities, that a passivity which withdraws them utterly from it all appears as something trivial, empty, useless and irksome. It is necessary for the aspiring to withdraw from time to time from their ordinary duties, and during such periods to observe whether they are making mistakes or condoning weaknesses, to take stock of past experiences and present ideas and to inquire into the best course of future development. This can most effectively be done in quiet countryside retreats or by peaceful seaside shores. It is not easily done in large noisy cities. Most men need this spell of retreat because they need at times a respite from the difficulties and struggles of life, so that they may collect their forces before continuing the effort to cope with them. They need to seek out places of secret retreat from the city's noise, intervals of peaceful remoteness from the city's bustle. This is to be done not as an escape from the life of the world but as a preparation for it.